This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? You think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, we go to threat level red as we look at filming abroad in a time of terrorism and political unrest. We'll talk to a man who knows the risks of filming just about anywhere and the producer who's experienced those risks firsthand. Plus, why has Pan's Labyrinth become the highest grossing Spanish language film in North American history? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. And now, the quote of the week. Sirius Satellite Radio CEO Mel Karmazin, grilled by the Antitrust Task Force of the House Judiciary Committee last week, had this to say about the proposed $13 billion XM-Sirius merger. Quote, "We are absolutely convinced this merger will be in the best interest of consumers," said Karmazin, adding, "This merger will give consumers more choice at a lower price and, more importantly, less confusion." Oh, and this just in, war is peace, freedom is slavery, and ignorance is strength. Meanwhile, did he or didn't he? London's High Court ruled last week that U.S. hip-hop star Sean Diddy Combs did, in fact, breach an agreement with a rival record producer not to use the alias Diddy in Britain. What triggered the dispute? London-based producer Richard Diddy Dearlove had argued that Combs broke their agreement not to use the Diddy sobriquet in the U.K. Dearlove said there had been violations on two fronts. One, Combs had referred to himself as Diddy in a recent song lyric. And two, people in Britain could see Combs' use of Diddy on MySpace and YouTube. But as Reuters points out, quote, "The judgment did not take the potentially more serious decision to order Combs to change his alias or stop using the hugely popular MySpace and YouTube internet sites, where his pages attract millions of viewers worldwide." Interestingly, the judge ruled that it was his record label, not Combs himself, who controlled the content of his pages on popular websites. And those companies were not party to the Dearlove Combs agreement reached last July. The record label's culpability in all this gets resolved when this goes to trial in October. Surely, an excellent use of the High Court's time. Finally, rats. It's a word being uttered by DreamWorks Animation, whose fourth quarter was plagued by the underperformance of the rodential adventure Flushed Away. The film is a $109 million write-off that drowned the studio's last quarter in $21 million worth of red ink. It's a shame DreamWorks is stuck in the middle of a two-year deal with McDonald's. Based on the headlines coming out of New York last week, DreamWorks' rat-themed Flushed Away clearly would have been a better fit for Taco Bell. Rat chalupa. Yummy. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, we review the 2007 Risks in Global Filmmaking map. And later, the producer who didn't check that map before embarking on his latest project. More and more movies and TV shows are filming in far-flung places, both for economic and creative reasons. Whatever their rationale, though, the producers of these films often turn to Aeon Albert G. Rubin to find insurance for their productions, cast, and crew. And getting insurance means assessing and reducing risk. Chris Palmer is the man who knows the dangers of filming in any particular location, from the possibility of terrorist attacks to kidnapping to political unrest or simply a lack of accessible medical care. He's director of risk control for Aeon Albert G. Rubin and author of their annual Risks in Global Filmmaking map. The 2007 map comes out next week. Chris Palmer, welcome to The Business.
Glad to be here.
How long have you been keeping track of these sorts of nasty things and why? What's your interest, Chris?
Well, basically, we've been tracking these risks here at Aeon Albert G. Rubin ever since the company started back in 1960. And particularly the world of international film production kind of came into its own not long after our company came into existence, you started to see more and more production going overseas, you know, Cleopatra, the Ten Commandments. These days, filming on location is a common thing as opposed to being something that's an exceptional film that does that. So basically, where we come in is to think about all of these possible risks that a filmmaker may encounter in these places so they can be prepared for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had films all over Africa. We've seen films go into Pakistan. We've seen films in Sri Lanka. We've seen films in Malaysia and Indonesia and on small islands, even in the Solomons in the Pacific. So these are places that filmmakers didn't normally go in the past. And so as a result, there's even more risks that people have to be aware of.
So give us, if you wouldn't mind, the executive summary of all this delicious terrorism and kidnapping and ransoms and disease. Give us the thumbnail sketch of how things look right now. Are things getting better or worse?
Well, I think I have to say overall, you know, the level of risk seems to be moderating in a number of countries. What we've seen, particularly countries that are destinations for filmmakers, you know, Eastern Europe has become a real focus. You know, places like Romania and Hungary and the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic. These are places that are building their infrastructures for filmmakers. The governments are very happy to encourage filmmakers to come there and film. And as a result, we're seeing not only the business infrastructure change, but also we're seeing some of the risks that had been there also improving. In Eastern Europe, there have always been some issues with crime and even organized crime and corruption. You know, we see those risks as improving, you know, especially in Romania and in the Czech Republic. They've become very film savvy, and they realize this is a great business to have there. And as a result, we're starting to see a lot more cooperation, and frankly, those risks are declining. In other parts of the world, you know, the risk of terrorism exists pretty much everywhere. The risk tends to follow the business or the individuals as much as it follows the country. And, you know, because a film is a big target. You know, if an American businessman is kidnapped, it's obviously news. If a Hollywood star or a Hollywood director is kidnapped, it is now round-the-clock news. And because of that, we're a little bit larger target than, say, would be a smaller business or one that's not as well-known.
Sure. We just had the Oscars, the high holidays here in Hollywood, and you underwrote, I think, a lot of the films that were nominated for Best Picture, including Babel. Tell me a little bit about your role in that and what unique risks they faced filming in far-flung places.
Well, sure. The first thing when we're brought into a project is to look at locations even when they're still being considered. You know, very often when a film is greenlit, you know, the script is approved, the casting may still be in process, and they're thinking about, well, you know, we need, for example, a desert location. Well, are we going to film in Morocco? Are we going to go to Tunisia? Will we film in the Sonoran Desert in Mexico? Will we film in the United States? We need a jungle location, same thing. And when producers are assessing those risks, they're generally looking at, obviously, you know, what matches the creative vision, and then obviously the business aspect of it. What's it going to cost? What are the logistics of being there? Where we come in is to say, well, okay, now let's look at the risks that may exist in going to those various places and see, you know, what costs may be involved there. You know, for example, if you want to, you know, film in the desert in Morocco, or filming in the desert, say the director said, I wanted to go to Algeria. Obviously going to Algeria would be a very expensive location because of the risks that are there. But in Babel's case in particular, when we start looking at all of these locations, and Babel was a very well-traveled film, you know, our job was to say, okay, we're going into Morocco. We've had a lot of experience there. I've spent a lot of time in Morocco on films myself. And looking at, you know, the biggest issue we faced, quite frankly, overall, Morocco is a very stable country. The terrorism threat is moderate. Our biggest concern was, more than anything else, was getting people to medical care. You know, you get into remote regions of the desert, you may very well be, you know, hundreds of miles from a capable medical facility.
Which is sort of the plot point of Babel,
I suppose. That's right. Life imitating art and vice versa.
Right.
That, you know, literally, you know, if you're filming down around Erfoud, you know, you are an 8 to 10 to 12-hour drive from a quality hospital. And as a result, that was something we had to plan for, as we have on other shows that are there. meaning that we have to have a means of taking care of people until we can get them to the local hospital and then transferring them from the local hospital to the more advanced care that's available in Rabat and Casablanca.
Now, do you supply the money if my leading man winds up bound and gagged in the back of a truck rolling somewhere in Pakistan? Would you supply the ransom, let's say, or is that something I need to have my agent handle?
Yeah, the kidnap and ransom insurance would take care of the ransom and obviously the handling of the payment of the ransom, the recovery of the person, whereas the production insurance, extra expense insurance, would pick up if that person wasn't able to work.
So if I'm a studio, obviously I'd like to see this production come in with a lower number rather than a higher number. Is there anything I can do, short of not going someplace, that will help me reduce my risk? What if I wrap my crew in Kevlar and have them bring, the shoddy with them, so to speak?
You know, in the film business, there's very few things we can't do safely if you have enough time, talent, and money. Having the right security, not only the adequate amount of security, but the right kind of security, having contingency plans in place. You know, what do we do if someone gets hurt? What do we do if the political situation in a country becomes untenable and we have to get out? If you look at an example of the film, The Year of Living Dangerously, you know, things can happen. Governments do fall. Things become unstable. And there are ways of planning for those contingencies and for getting your people out safely. And in addition to the security, but just the physical aspect of it, if something becomes unstable in a country, it's not like you're just going to call up and buy 150 plane tickets and get on the next plane and get out. It doesn't work that way. So you have contingency plans in place that, if need be, an aircraft can be brought in specifically to get your people out. You can evacuate people over land. The same thing applying that, if you're going into a place, the medical care is not very good. We've had shows that have literally brought their own field hospitals, doctors, nurses, paramedics, emergency equipment, x-ray machines, EKG machines, even ventilators in some cases.
How fine is the tuning on your risk assessment? That is, if I'm a American director, do you adjust for that variable? Or if I'm, say, a Jewish American director in a radically Islamic country, do you adjust for that?
Definitely. The nature, when I said that the risk follows the individual sometimes more than the activity, that's very true. There are some countries where being an American company, quote-unquote, is a considerably higher risk than being a British company, being a Belgian company, being a German company, or being a Moroccan company. Obviously, those risks do vary, particularly when you start looking at the terrorism threat, when you start looking at the possibility of just overall disruptions. One of the things that we find very useful when shows go into a country is, the cultural sensitivities are very important. It's one thing that, you can go into a place that's very, very safe, but, if your crew comes in and if you drastically offend the local culture, suddenly you might have a picket line or someone might even attack your show. So these are obviously all things that enter into it. Basically anything that can disrupt or impact that production, it's our job to help identify and control.
Chris Palmer is director of risk control for Aon Albergy Rubin and author of their annual Risks in Global Filmmaking Map. Chris, thanks for joining us on The Business.
Thank you.
For a link to the Risks in Global Filmmaking Map, check out our website at kcrw.org/thebusiness. The 2007 map will be available later this week. The Risks in Global Filmmaking Map says that Colombia poses a significant risk for crime and corruption, terrorist attacks, and kidnapping. But if you're going to make a movie based on a novel by South American magical realist Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you kind of have to go to South America. Hollywood has been pounding on his door for years, but it was producer Scott Steindorf that finally convinced Marquez to let him film an American version of Love in the Time of Cholera with director Mike Newell. After Marquez said, "Sí," Steindorf suddenly realized he was going to be taking a very large, very high-profile American film crew down to South America. The crew finished filming in Colombia in December. Scott Steindorf, welcome to The Business.
Hi, thanks.
You look remarkably composed for a guy who spent 5-6 months in the jungles of Colombia. Let's talk about what brought you down there and how you made the decision to go to Colombia to shoot Love in the Time of Cholera.
Well, we initially were going to film the movie in Brazil. And I started prepping the movie in Brazil. And I got a call from the vice president of Colombia, Francisco Santos, who assured me and promised me complete safety if I were to shoot Love in the Time of Cholera in Colombia. And I was very reluctant to even visit Colombia because I had heard all the horror stories of Colombia and the dangers. And he was very passionate, and I convinced the director, Mike Newell, that we should go visit Cartagena for the primary reason of looking at the city, because that's where Gabriel Garcia Marquez wrote and created Love in the Time of Cholera. So Mike and I and the production designer, Wolf Kruger, went to Cartagena, Colombia, and immediately fell in love with the city. It's one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It's a 500-year-old city. It's walled. It has so much character. And they're the actual locations of the story. We could go to the old theater, which was the theater that he wrote about, the park that he wrote about, the houses that he wrote about. We went to the authentic locations.
Did he have any opinions on where it would be shot, or did he not care having signed over the rights?
Well, it was kind of a funny story because he came here to my office, and I have a map of the world, and I was showing him places in Brazil I was going to shoot, and I said, should I shoot here or should I shoot in Colombia? And he said, well, you'll probably be dead in both places. He has a great sense of humor because he knows the dangers of South America.
Let's talk about the process.
When I landed in Colombia, I went to Bogota, and the vice president showed me a very interesting piece on Colombia called Perception versus Reality. The perception of Colombia is one of danger, kidnappings, shootings, killings. And they're very frank about that. It does occur in certain areas of Colombia. Cartagena is a tourist town. It's a safe haven. Even in the heyday of Pablo Escobar, it was a place that was a peaceful place. No war, everybody get along and vacation. It was always this safe haven territory. So we knew that Cartagena was relatively safe. The government assured us protection. They gave us secret police who report to the president and vice president. It's their particular security force. The Cartagena police, the Colombian police. So I had a lot of security. There was times when I really felt I didn't need any security.
How many guys are with you at all times?
I had three personal bodyguards, and I made sure the lead actors and director had a bodyguard at all times. You know, there's an interesting story. I run, and it was Saturdays. We work 6 days, and Saturdays were our day off. And so on Saturday, I like to run. So I didn't have my security. I would give them the day off. And my girlfriend was very concerned about my safety and said, don't go out without security on Saturdays. Stay in the house. So I snuck out early in the morning to take a run. And I stopped to gaze out at the city, and I looked behind me, and I saw my security detail. And I'm thinking to myself, this is their day off. What are they doing? And I called them over to me. And they said that they watch me 24 hours a day because they will lose their job if something happens to me.
Coming up after a short break, we'll have more with Scott Steindorf, the producer of the upcoming film Love in the Time of Cholera. He got back from 5 months of filming in Colombia in early December. You're listening to The Business from NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Scott Steindorf was the first producer to convince legendary South American novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez to option one of his novels to an American film company. But that was just the first hurdle. Steindorf had to take a very large, very high-profile American film crew to Colombia, where kidnapping and violence are part of everyday life. How much more did you have to pay in insurance and special arrangements to shoot this where you shot it?
An interesting story here. Our insurance carrier, the person that worked for the insurance company, his wife and him had honeymooned in Cartagena, Colombia, and felt very safe. If it weren't for that fact, we probably weren't going to get insured.
Was there anything that happened while you were shooting that maybe looked scary but turned out to not be, or vice versa?
We shot on a ranch, and it was an emerald ranch. There's a lot of emeralds in Colombia. And the guy that owned the property had a private army, and his private army consisted of 2,000 soldiers. So we were protected by his soldiers who were protecting his vast resources on his property of emeralds against rebel forces. So again, I felt very secure because he had a private army.
Finally, I'm just wondering, you know, where are you going next?
I'm going back to South America.
To do?
I can't tell you yet what I'm going to do, but I'm looking at doing another movie in Colombia and another movie in Brazil. I love South America. It's safe, it's beautiful, and it's the Wild West.
All at once.
All in once. You have to be somewhat adventurous, but I love South America.
Scott Steindorf is the producer of movies like Turista and the forthcoming Love in the Time of Cholera. We spoke to him at his office overlooking beautiful Sunset Boulevard. Scott, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you very much.
Here's a recipe for box office disaster in the U.S. Take a heartbreaking story about a little girl who creates a mythical world to escape the harsh reality of the Spanish Civil War. Then give it to a Hollywood director better known for movies based on comic books like Hellboy and Blade 2. And yet, Guillermo del Toro's film Pan's Labyrinth has become the highest-grossing Spanish-language film in North American history. Not to mention, it's 6 Oscar nominations and 3 Oscar wins. Bob Burney is the president of Picture House, which distributed Pan's Labyrinth in the U.S. and Canada. Bob Burney, welcome to The Business.
Thank you. It's great to be in Santa Monica.
Let's talk about Pan's Labyrinth. And in particular, I'm interested, why is it that this is the number one grossing Spanish language film of all time in America?
I think one thing is that it's in a way it's caught on and sort of language isn't the issue. I think the storytelling and the imagery that Guillermo uses like trumps the language issue. So therefore, I think the film expanded beyond what is kind of the expected of a, quote, foreign language film.
Right. I mean, did you guys do research on, you know, how it would perform with English language speakers or Spanish language speakers? And did you have plans in place that you either hewed to or abandoned?
Yeah, we did. We did research screenings just to really, I mean, I had a gut instinct that it would play, you know, to a genre audience and to Latino audience and to an art film audience and reviews, and we tested it in several places, one including like Orange County, and it went through the roof, and it was very, very equal to it didn't matter if you really spoke Spanish, but the Spanish speaking audience loved the movie as well. So it really I felt early that it would cross over. I think the other thing was that it played as a Guillermo movie, as a genre movie, even though I think it's you know, obviously very emotional and sort of a leap ahead of a typical genre movie. His fans are very, very strong.
Well, you also released Y Tu Mama Tambien when you were at IFC Films.
Yes.
You're at Picture House now.
Yeah.
We should tell our dear listeners. But what's different in this case? You know, it's a Mexican film rather than one set in fascist Spain. But, I mean, were there lessons you learned? Was there just – is there something inherently different about it?
No, it's not. I think it was more what's similar. The lessons we learned, I think, were to keep very true to the story and keep the marketing of the picture organic to the film on Y Tu Mama. I think one thing on that film, we didn't change the title. It was clearly a Spanish film from a Mexican director. I think what's happened is I think the audience, the independent audience, and the just the movie audience has grown and accepted more and more, particularly genre films in foreign language. I think the audience has developed and grown. If you look at the Asian films, you know, not just Crouching Tiger, but so many films after that that have become so popular here that the subtitles or the language issues don't matter. And I think the genre nature of Pan's Labyrinth is why it sort of outperformed. I think the audience has grown since Itu Mama in general, just accepting anything outside of the sort of more formulaic studio film.
Did you do anything special in terms of marketing for Spanish language audiences? I ask because we recently sat down with the marketing firm for Ugly Betty, and you know they sort of crafted this whole campaign around the idea, you know, so ugly we made it in English. Was there any of that, or was it just, you know, the core constituency will show up because of the content?
Well, I felt they would show up, but we did do a lot of targeted advertising in Spanish, both television, radio, print advertising. We had a lot of screenings in where we could attract a big Latino audience to the screening. So we definitely went after them. And I also felt like naturally Guillermo, you know, just being Guillermo would attract it. We did that with the Spanish language. We did a lot of cultivation of the genre audience. We went down to Comic-Con, you know, where we built, from the people that haven't seen the movie, there's a big tree that the girl goes into and has to find stuff out of this frog that throws up, you know, his insides. And so we had a tree where thousands of fans had to stick their hands in goop to get a key.
Did you ever show it without the subtitles to the Spanish language audience?
We had a few films that were just without subtitles, a few prints of it. Mm. But mainly I think that, you know, that's for some specialized theaters that really only do that. But for the most part, I think that we reach the audience through just the regular mainstream theaters.
We're taping this on a Friday morning before the Oscars. Mm-hmm. We don't know, obviously, what's going to happen. You are nominated for Best Foreign Film along with a lot of other interesting movies. How important is Oscar to the continuing success of Pan's Labyrinth? Or does it not matter at this point?
I mean, I think what's been important is the nominations, because when we open the film at the end of December, we go into this sort of, you know, 6-week period of where you're spending all the money to open the film, and the nominations really did pique interest, I think, in a broader audience that maybe was on the fence, but then when they see those nominations, they go, we've got to try that and, you know, go to the film. So I think the important thing, I think, for the success of Pan's has been the nominations. And I think we've captured most of the business in a way that it'll do, but if it wins, it'll definitely extend it.
Mm-hmm. But what kind of dollar figure can you put on it? Do you mean if it gets an Oscar, are you going to make X more?
I think the nominations have got us where we are, and we'll do a couple million more. I don't think it's tremendously important on the actual theatrical box office at this point, but in the long life of the film on DVD and everything else, it'll be good. Plus, Guillermo's going to be so much happier. You know, it's going to be a tough moment sitting next to him, you know.
Yeah.
As we go to that moment.
Let go of my knee. Let go of my knee.
You got it.
Bob Burney is head of Picture House. They're distributing Pan's Labyrinth, which is in theaters nationwide. Bob, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks a lot, Claude.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Business. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Treatment, a weekly conversation with some of the most influential and innovative people in movies and popular entertainment, hosted by film critic Elvis Mitchell. Check out the podcast of The Treatment at kcrw.com.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 7-passenger MDX.
More information is available at Acura.com.